Welcome to Turning Pages, a series of in-depth conversations with authors about their works.
All right. Well, it's described as a memoir in pieces in the subtitle. Son of Elsewhere finds El Amin Abdul Mahmoud reflecting on a highway and a whole lot of things that have brought him to where he is today. Welcome to the show, El Amin.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for putting a little bit of effort into the Mahmoud. You know, that's always a nice welcome.
Oh, well, you know, you talk about it at the end, right, in the aid ceremony, that like hearing other people say their name and kind of anglicize it.
Yes, sir.
That you want to kind of like put a little spin on it. And so I went online to hear you kind of introduce yourself, and I gave you the most accurate version this white guy could give you. So
it was great. It was a 10 out of 10. Absolutely no notes. Thank you for that. Thank you for the effort, man. I really appreciate that.
Wonderful. I want to start with wrestling.
As all things
start, as you know, as a memoir about a child from Sudan, it just... That's exactly where your head goes when you say, you know, kid who moves from Sudan at age 12. No, the reason I want to start with it is because you write about joining these e-feds where you create like wrestling characters. I mean, initially you're doing like actual WWE figures and dramatizing them, but then you start to kind of invent your own characters and write about it. But in it, you talk about kind of creating this composite character, the two of the guys in your class. And you started listening to their conversations about, you know, phrasing and how they behave themselves and drawing on these things. And I'm curious, were these powers of observation something you had when you lived in Sudan before you moved to Canada? Or is this like a coping mechanism you've developed or a skill you learned upon coming to Canada?
Oh, gosh, I can't. If these powers existed, if we can call them powers, if they exist in Sudan, I certainly have no memories of them. I think I just became much more sensitive to the social cues around me after I came to Canada, because the whole time I'm trying to sort of assemble a path forward, right? I'm trying to assemble how do I conduct myself in a way that makes all of these interactions easy, makes it so that I put the people around me at ease in a certain way. And I sort of was watching these guys and the way that they move and the way that they make people laugh and the lightness that they kind of carried with them, but also the seriousness that they were sort of taken with. And to me, I was like, I'd like that. Like, that sounds good to me. But I think at the time I was always searching for examples of how to conduct oneself. Like, I think like if you're a new immigrant who's coming to Canada by necessity, the first little stretch of your time here, you're basically an anthropologist, right? You're basically someone who's trying to, you know, you crack open your little notebook and you say, well, Canadians do this when they're trying to do this, because you're trying to understand how to move in that space in that world as well. And trying to incorporate the characteristics of these guys into a wrestling character was, for me, personally, a delight, because I get to sort of invent scenarios and be like, well, how would a person who's kind of like this, how would they behave in this kind of scenario? Of course, at the time, I didn't think of it, didn't think of it this complexly, because I was so deeply woven into this e-fed wrestling world. But now that I think about it, I was literally just trying out different scenarios and literally just trying out different characteristics in different contexts. And I think I learned a lot by observing and then trying to recreate that observation.
You mentioned that being kind of like an anthropological activity for a person who, you know, immigrates. But I mean, for many teenagers, trying on, you know, identities or seeing what fits is, it's a universal thing, right? Like finding yourself is very much that period of time. I mean, it has to be heightened, obviously, by coming to a new country, but that, like, I mean, maybe this is just me, like, projecting, but, like, I did not feel at ease in my early teens.
Yeah.
And so the people that were at ease were, like, how did they do that?
Well, the people, I mean, I'm not sure that they were at ease so much as I looked at them and thought, they seem more at ease than I am. I think, like, for me, when I think about that period of time, you're absolutely right. There is something about the teenage years that sort of gives you this impression of I'm just trying on different identities. I'm just trying on different ideas to try to see how I belong. I was sort of stuck in a double jeopardy kind of situation, in the sense of, okay, I'm an immigrant and I'm Black and I'm Muslim and I'm in a town that is predominantly white, and I'm trying not to draw attention to all these things, so also trying to figure out what to draw attention to. And so that was the balance, right? I think if I had arrived in this country a little bit earlier, I would have maybe adapted a little bit sooner. And if I had arrived a little bit later, I think I would have had this idea of Sudan as, like, more so of my home than Canada. And so arriving at 12 is, like, a very sensitive kind of middle space. And I think that's kind of where I found myself.
Yeah. Now, that obviously was by necessity in terms of, like, the timing of when your dad came to Canada first and when you and your mother were able to come over. Was there any talk about, like, kind of like how to prepare a 12-year-old for this drastic change in the midst of, you know, like a growth change, intellectually and physically?
I wish there were. I wish there was a guidebook, a handbook for parents, or like, here's how to prepare your teenager for an entirely different universe. However, there isn't something like that. There's just kind of the hope that they'll figure it out, right? The hope that they're going to figure out their place in this new society. They'll figure out who they want to talk to, who their people are. And they don't always succeed in doing so. So I would say that, like, no, that I didn't get the impression that my parents were particularly prepared for that part of the transition. Well, partly because they themselves were going through that transition. My dad had only been in this country for about 4 or 5 years at that point. And my mom came with me when I came. And so we kind of were all fish out of water, except we kind of had slightly different waters.
You talk about kind of the immigrant parent kind of not necessarily recoiling, but like tightening the reins on a child.
Yeah.
And that this is across immigrant experiences, no matter what country they come from, this is kind of a reactionary thing. Whereas the life you describe in Khartoum is very, like, free and open, right? Like, you talk about, you know, choosing which mosque you're going to go to and walking across town and kind of the ease with which you had unrestricted mobility. And then that's entirely, like, curtailed. Can you think back to, you know, like, 12, 13-year-old you and psychologically, like, what kind of those limitations did to you?
I think I predominantly just wanted to rebel against them, because those limitations were mostly limitations about my parents' fear, right? It was a fear of sort of, okay, we don't really know the people here. We don't know how they behave in Sudan. They could basically trust anyone on the street to keep me safe, to discipline me if they needed to let them know if I was doing something that I should not have been doing, to let them know if I was under threat in any kind of way. All of those things were the case in Sudan. And then suddenly, you know, you come to Canada, you find myself here, they just didn't know. They just didn't know what it was that was kind of right in front of them. And as a result, they tightened the reins, because it's just the fear of the unknown. And I think, like, at the time, it all just felt like constraints all around. You know, you got to be home by 7. I'm not sure you can hang out with those friends. I'm not sure you can go to that place. But I guess reflecting on it now, you know, 20 years later, I have a bit of empathy for that. I have a bit of empathy for their fear and their anxiety. Because they were so overwhelmed by the not knowing.
Yeah, some of the last section kind of details, you know, as you make the drive to and from their place in these recent years, that it seems like you describe a softening of your feelings towards them.
Yeah, it took time to get there because I sort of needed to understand the things that they went through, to understand the motivations behind their actions, but also understand that I, while having a lot of empathy and sympathy for my younger self, I also didn't exactly make it easy. We butted heads a lot during that period of time, and I don't think I was specifically trying to understand them or their point of view. So much of this book is about coming back around and coming back around to trying to figure out, you know, the ways that we're trying to meet each other in the middle all the time, and then spending time with that, trying to spend time with that place of softness.
You're a father of a young child now.
I sure am, a five-year-old.
Has that parenthood experience also changed the way you look at your parents?
It has. It has. It truly has, in specifically in the ways of, you know, I think about all the efforts that I'm making to make sure that my daughter knows that a part of her doesn't come from here. She's born in Toronto. She is only sort of vaguely familiar with Sudan. When I think about all my efforts to try to make her a bit more aware of where she comes from, I kind of remind myself of my parents, except they were dealing with a slightly older version of me. My daughter doesn't make it easy because she's five and most of her job is to watch Disney movies. When my parents were trying to remind me of all these things, I was a little bit older. I sort of had the option to listen to them, and I don't think I exercise that option very often. And so I'm thinking about them a fair bit these days.
That other place that you talk about, obviously it's the elsewhere that's in the title.
Yeah.
And you describe it as a dangerous place. In fact, you compare it to a volcano.
Yeah.
Living on the edge or holding in you a place like a volcano, you know, do you have the opportunity to feel at peace at any point when something so combustible or so dangerous lives inside your head or in your heart?
You know, it can be dangerous in the sense that it can be a bit destabilizing, a bit volatile. But the danger, I'm not sure if the danger is the salient point of elsewhere for me. You know, like it's like this idea that this volcano is two homelands butting into each other and trying to figure out something else in the middle. And sometimes it fills you up with like really big, deep emotions, and you're trying to really allot, trying to figure out how much of yourself to allot to each homeland. I think that's a hard calculus to go through. But I think for the most part, I think you can claim that space. You can claim that space of the middle, try to figure out, saying, okay, I exist in between this space and this space. What does the in-between look like? What does it mean to exist in between these spaces? It doesn't have to be a dangerous space. I think it just can be sometimes.
So it's the space where when after the volcano erupts and then it meets water and then becomes that hardened rock, like it's yeah, calm and it's weirdly beautiful, but a little damaged and a little rocky.
It's new, right? I think that's most importantly, that it's like it's new, right? Like it's we're literally creating new land here. We're literally creating sort of a solid space that is in between.
You've only been back to Sudan once.
I have. It's true. 2009. It's been a minute.
When it comes to writing the like very descriptive passages, how much memory did you have to draw from? And like, did you, you know, Google Earth Khartoum and try to pull up kind of things to describe them better? Or like, was it just like so seared into your memory from when you left Sudan?
I mean, that's the thing. It's like, that's the thing about leaving at 12. Like 12 is old enough to remember most things, right? Most of us have memories from our early teens. I think if I'd come a little bit younger, then Sudan would sort of be a bit more hazy in my memory. And I think if I'd come a little bit older, then it'd be solidified, but maybe I'd be a bit more skeptical of this sort of new space. But I think I came in this very sensitive in-between space that lets Sudan live kind of cherished in my memory while also kind of embracing whatever new homeland I was coming to.
In the book, you weave in stories about the 401. And your own travels on that highway. Obviously, it's the road that led you to your new home, and so you write pretty credibly about that. But was that always the idea to weave this road like as an arterial pathway through your memoir?
I mean, it didn't start off being that way. What ended up happening is I wrote that essay about the 401, and I just kept on having more and more things to say about the 401 because I sort of had so many moments of emotional value in the 401. A lot of moments of, confronting the ways that I thought about my parents, confronting the ways that I sort of limited my own blackness in my mind early on. A lot of those moments of discovery happened on the 401. And as I kept writing, it sort of became clear to me two things. One, this is, it's, it kind of lines up with a lot of different points in my life. It's not just early, it's also later points in my life. All of these things are happening in the 401. And two, and perhaps more importantly, the piece was too long. The piece was just like such a long sort of beast of a piece that ended up being about a little over 12,000 words, a little over, actually closer to 13,000 words. And so early on, I sort of had this idea of splitting up the piece into a couple of pieces. And as I sort of introduced that framework of splitting up the piece, it became apparent to me that so much of it lines up with different points in my life, just chronologically speaking. And so what that's what I did. I sort of ended up weaving the 401 essay into the book so that it acts as five different essays. But some of the trick of the trade that I'm revealing now is that it was all written all at once, and then we just kind of sculpted it to fit around different chronological points.
So that's you and your editor sorting out kind of how to break it up and fit it into the overall narrative of the rest of the story.
Yeah, and that's I think like they often say that like books are sort of written twice, one when you write it, and then the second when you edit it. That certainly is the case for me. Another sort of big editing decision is that opening piece, the prologue that is elsewhere. So the book is bookended by two essays, each called Elsewhere. One is a prologue, one is an epilogue. But they were both also written at the same time. They were initially meant to be the very end piece of the book. This was going to be the thing that ends the whole thing. But after I wrote it, I sort of felt so strongly that this was like the mission statement of the book that we basically took half of it and put it right up front. And then we kept the other half for the bottom for the very end. And the reason I'm revealing all of this is that like it works because this is the through line that connects the whole book. But also books change so much from the moment that you write them. It's that the writing is one of the jobs, and then the clarifying is the next job. And part of the clarifying is figuring out where needs to go, what needs to go where.
Well, I appreciate you revealing this because I'm very process oriented myself, and I tend to ask process questions. So,
Sure. No, I love process questions, man. That's my joy too.
As much as the 401 is the road of choice through this book, at times it feels like you're on Highway 2. And I say this because some of the essays you talk about kind of like these smaller towns that become curiosities or like little offshoots and bedroom communities and a writing about the OC or some of these other topics feel like stops on the Highway 2 trip rather than rest stops on the 401. Was there any thought to kind of like how the highway shaped or flavored what where your stops were?
I honestly, when I started thinking about the off ramps, if you will, that I think about those essays as kind of off ramps. Like we're stopping here for a minute. We're stopping here because we need to explore this particular idea. It became important to me to sort of have each essay transition into the next roads piece. So whenever you sort of are about to meet a roads piece, I'm kind of setting you up for that next roads piece. It gave the book a lot of structure for me to sort of have this highway piece be the thing that connects all of it, because then I could go back to the essays that were slated to be right before the roads pieces and figure out, how does this connect to the highway, or how does this connect to the next thing that I'm going to talk about in the highway pieces. And hopefully, when someone reads this book, they go, okay, I understand why this is structured this way. This is meant to be kind of a rest stop, or this is meant to be kind of this larger sort of detour for me to spend some time with this idea.
Right. I want to pivot to music. When you first come to Canada, your cousin, I believe it was your cousin, hands you Illmatic and Miseducation of Lauryn Hill.
Yes.
Because you're black now. In Canada, that's what she told you. And you recoil from that. You reject it. And instead, eventually, you come to love country music.
Yeah.
And I mean, the distinction, or rather the connection you make is with Sudanese music. And you say, you know, the music was born out of conflict. I'm quoting you here from late in the book. Just as Sudan's identity is a delicate balance, a dance between Arab influences and African traditions, the music contains the same careful mix. And country music, as you know, point out, it's the fiddle and the banjo. It's the European and the African. And you find a connection to that music, and it speaks to you. I'm curious if you can kind of talk about the, like, point at which, like, was there a specific song that you heard that first forced you to be like, wait, country music, this is what I grew up on. This is the stuff that I heard in my heart or on the streets in Khartoum.
Well, let me first say that there was a bit of time between country music and this idea of rejecting hip hop. You know, like, I sort of rejected hip hop and rap music very early on, but then found my way to them probably by university. I sort of, you know, would say I was someone who listened to most genres. In fact, the thing to say at the time was, I listened to all music except for country. Like, somehow that makes you cool or something. Country music is a relatively late addition to my life. I probably found country music maybe six or seven years ago or so. And sort of been deeply into it since. The thing that got me into it was not a specific song, but an album. Specifically the Byrds 1968 Sweetheart of the Rodeo. It's a perfect album as far as I'm concerned, you know. It's an album that blends rock and roll and country in a deeply meaningful way. It's the one that Graham Parsons had a hand in sort of steering. And initially the Byrds wanted to do this, like, history of all American music in one record, and Graham Parsons kind of convinced him to go, that's not what we need. We need something that defines American music. And American music is a blend of folk and a blend of country and a blend of the blues. When you mix them all together, maybe gospel in there too. And that's what you get. You get Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And when I first heard Sweetheart of the Rodeo, I was really struck, because these are songs about faith. These are songs about the physical places you exist. These are songs about geography. And that's what so much of Sudanese music is about. And so I was immediately drawn to that. I was immediately drawn to sort of this idea of, ooh, this, there's a genre that deals with this stuff, and I'm really interested in this stuff. And so I want to spend some time with that. And as I sort of spent some more time, I delved in deeper. Next, I found Emmylou Harris, which is sort of a natural pathway from Graham Parsons and the Byrds. And next, I, you know, fell in love with the whole genre, and I still am.
When you talk about, you know, like, your shoulders change when you listen to country music, that, like, you hold your body differently.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think, like, my wife says she knows I'm having a good day when I'm, like, listening to country in the shower. I'm like, yeah, that checks out. Like, that feels like it's true to me. Those are definitely the good days.
Have you listened to the new Charlie Crockett record? Are you into him?
I am into Charlie Crockett, but I haven't heard the new record. How is it?
Jukebox Charlie, it's good. Yeah.
All right. See, this is great. I love being recommended new music, or music I haven't thought about in a minute. That sounds wonderful.
Sure enough. You also get into new metal for a time.
Yeah, that was my first music, is, you know, getting into new metal, because it felt like, oh, this matches, like, my broody teenage anger. And this was, I mean, like, this was the heydays of new metal, you know. Like, if anything, new metal is mostly just remembered for this, like, stretch of time between, like, 1999 and 2003. I don't want to say it too bluntly, but I think new metal mostly died with Meteora, with Linkin Park's Meteora in 2003. But these were These happened to be the really deeply formative years for me. And I was grateful to have new metal when I needed it to say, I'm mad at things and this music is also mad at things and let's be mad at things together. Because up until that point, I didn't know that you could be that angry. I didn't know that you were allowed to be that angry. And then music comes along and says, actually you are, here's some proof about the ways you could be angry.
Yeah, I spoke to Ian Williams around the time of his book Disorientation, and we were talking about how like the music that comes along in your teenage years, you know, has to connect on that like intrinsic level of being speaking to kind of the primal you.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. There's something about that period of time that it just gets imprinted upon you, right? It just kind of like this is the thing that I'm choosing to hit the wagon to because it speaks to me more clearly than everything else. And it doesn't matter how many years later, it doesn't matter if like 20 years later, you're like, oh, I can objectively recognize that this is like not good music, quote, good music. But it's still special to you. It's still sort of heartwarming. We just had the book launch here in Toronto, and the number of folks who were at the book launch who came up to me and were like, hey, did you make this playlist? Was numerous, and it's because there were more than one Linkin Park song out there, and I was like, yeah, I did that. That is definitely a thing that I did.
Well, you're emotionally tethered to it, right? Like in the same way that I think all of us still somewhat picture ourselves as teenagers in our heads.
Yeah, and it can return you there, right? It can return you to that feeling if you need to be returned to that feeling. So much of those moments when I was trying to write my way through them, I listened to this music to sort of keep my body in that feeling, to remember what that felt like.
And that, I mean, that's this book too, that you're tethered to Khartoum, you're tethered to Kingston, you're tethered to the 401, that like these places and moments, you can go back there. And that maybe that's like elsewhere is a psychological or emotional state ultimately.
It is. That's more than anything else. It is a state that you have to sort of invite yourself into being in, because it's very easy to slip out of it. It's very easy to sort of not be there. It's a choice that you got to make to say, you know what? I choose to keep myself in liminality. I choose to keep myself suspended in the middle because it requires that I remember that a part of me doesn't come from here. That's important to me right now. And so many people can make the choice to escape from that, if you will. So many people can make the choice to say, no, I don't want to. I don't want to remember that there's a history, that I have a history elsewhere. I have a history outside of this country. And I think choosing to remember that is really important to me personally. And that's what this book is about.
Well, the book is Son of Elsewhere. It's out through McClelland and Stewart. Elamine, thanks very much for taking some time to talk about it.
Oh my gosh, man. Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to go listen to that Charlie Crockett record.